In this second hour of Midday, a conversation with Samuel Hoy, president of the Maryland Institute College of Art at the end of his first year at the school. We'll talk about Micah's role in the revitalization of Station North and the role of art and artists in post-Freddie Gray Baltimore. We'll also meet some accomplished Micah alumni, including a student whose video game is helping patients suffering from brain injuries. Plus, Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal breaks down the Supreme Court decision on power plants and talks about the environmental impact of Governor Larry Hogan's decision to kill the Red Line project through Baltimore. First, the news from NPR. Welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us, everybody. Hope you're joining our program today. Later on in this hour, our friend Rona Cabell will be back with us. Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal to talk about the Supreme Court's decision to strike down Environmental Protection Agency air quality regulations when it comes to power plants, coal-fired power plants, and what that means for Maryland. Rona will be joining us for a few minutes at the end of this hour. But first, in this hour, an opportunity for a conversation for the first time today. Samuel Hoy, president of the Maryland Institute College of Art here in Baltimore, came to town last July, took over from Micah's longtime leader, Fred Lazarus. Samuel Hoy, nice to have you on the show with us today.
Thank you, Dan, for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure to meet you. You came from, your last job was at Otis College of Art and Design in L.A.
That's right.
How long had you been there?
14 years.
Wow. And what can you talk about that school a little bit? I'm curious. I've never heard of it, Otis College of Art and Design, but I'm not in the art academic world. So
yeah, actually, within the art and design world, it's a very well-known school. Mm-hmm. It has some flagship programs and innovative ones. We're one of the very first toy design program and one of the first digital media program. But the school, like Micah, also has a very long and distinguished history in fine arts as well. Mm. And so the school is also an advocate for the creative economy in Los Angeles.
What was your own background in art?
I have actually a dual background in law and art.
After
law school, after getting a license to practice and then promptly retiring, I actually went to Parsons School of Design for my art and design training. So I have actually dual training in law and art.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Hong Kong and came to the United States at the age of 17.
And you arrive in Baltimore at a pretty interesting time this past year, these last few months. I would say pretty interesting time. A tough time for the city, I would say.
Yes, but challenging times.
But interesting in terms of what Micah's been up to. Micah got busier and busier, it seemed, just in the last few years, and just as you arrive, even busier. So there's a lot going on. I want to talk about some of the projects going on with Micah, but also to get your impressions of Baltimore, and especially the last few months. First of all, you know, the appeal of this job for you at Micah and the city.
You know, I love my previous job in Los Angeles, and I love the city of Los Angeles, so I wouldn't leave it unless I feel that there's great potential for my next dedication in both a city and also the school that I would serve. And I definitely saw in Baltimore and in Micah a very distinctive and important opportunities, not just for myself, but really for art and design education in the United States and in the world. So I came to Baltimore wanting to come to a city that's a very fertile social laboratory of both opportunities and challenges. So when you mentioned that the last few months has been particularly challenges, I completely agree with you. But at the same time, as being a newcomer and maybe having the history to afford me to be more optimistic, I also saw great opportunity for some of the underlying dynamics for the city to surface in such a powerful way that as a newcomer to town, I feel that there is a potential collective resolve now for multi-sector leaders to come together to try to address some of the fundamental issues. So I really definitely see an equal balance of opportunities and challenges.
A week after the riot here, late April riot, April 27th riot, about a week or so after that, the Baltimore Sun published an op-ed that you co-wrote with Jeannie Howe, who is the executive director of the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance, and Skip Sanders, who runs the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, with Samuel Hoy, reframing Baltimore after Freddie Gray. Let us reframe the perception of Baltimore. I mean, I think a lot of people would like to right away do that, but it's very difficult given the images that flashed around the world of the unrest here and what remains ahead. Big questions about not only about the police-community relations in the city, but the high concentration of poverty in the city is another issue. There's several, you know, there's lots of issues here. But you're expressing some optimism in this piece that is very, I mean, it's great. It's great to read that, but you say the moment is ripe to redefine our own understanding of the city.
Yes, I think that in order to really address the aftermath of the unrest in a very responsible way, we have to look at both immediate and midterm response that deals with the healing, the recognition, but also setting a very determined and tenacious dialogue about what why it happened. And then with that, we also need to, in the long term, I think, take a very proactive approach and not just respond to a crisis, but in a way take a look at the potential of the city and the renaissance of the city actually that Baltimore has enjoyed, and partly the reason I was attracted to Baltimore up to this point. You know, what are the strengths there and what are the issues that may be left unaddressed in that renaissance that we actually need to address in a more powerful way now so that we can arrive at a socially powerful, economically vibrant, and equitable way of moving the city forward. So I would say that's the optimism underlying that piece. And I think it's really about, again, not whitewashing the issues that we must address, but at the same time seize the opportunity to go with some of the opportunities that exist in the city.
I'm curious what you hear from MICA students about Baltimore, why they're here. Many of them stay after they finish with college and stay and work here. You have artists who've colonized Baltimore City. We're going to talk about Station North in a little while and the great potential there we're already seeing. But what do you hear from them about the culture here, about those problems that surfaced in April?
Sure, I can share with you what I've heard, but we have three alumni joining us
later. Will in a little while.
Exactly, so they will share their own opinions. Well, first of all, we have a very diverse set of alumni, so there are many, many reasons and responses for them to come to Baltimore and also decide to stay in Baltimore. According to our alumni research, we have about 40 to 45% of our graduates staying in Baltimore for at least 3 years after graduation. I would say that they're attracted to Baltimore. A lot of them were attracted to Baltimore because of MICA. MICA is a world-class institution with a strong reputation. So people come for our faculty, for our programs, but they also come to Baltimore because Baltimore is actually one of the cool city that has really emerged during the last decade. It's well known within the art and design set that this is the place you can come and genre hop between design and music and art and crossing over to neurosciences and crossing over to other disciplines. So that kind of fertile environment for the kind of the creative millennials are very, very attractive to our students.
I mean, that's what I hear. That's what I pick up from people in that scene is, the city's gritty. It's not perfect.
Correct.
But it's got a lot of coolness to it. It's affordable.
Yeah,
you can do multiple things here. And there's all kinds of circles of
and affordability is very, very important for emerging artists. Coming from a city like Los Angeles, now Baltimore is its own city, so I don't want to compare it to another city unfairly, but it does remind me of Los Angeles of 50 years ago when you have the proximity of the entertainment industry. You have a lot of creative artists who were reinterpreting, art and design in their own age, and then also with a tremendous diversity and technology, and they all add up to a very potent kind of primordial, soup for innovation to come forth. And I think Baltimore actually, in its own way, is at that kind of a stage on the verge of just bursting forth. And I think that's also part of the optimism that I have for the city.
Samuel Hoy is our guest. He's the president of the Maryland Institute College of Art. MICA, 410-662-8780 is the phone number for the Midday Show. If you have a comment or question for Samuel Hoy, President Hoy, while he's with us. In fact, Steve has just called in with a question for you. Steve, who's not far from here in Charles Village. Go right ahead, Steve. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I wanted to ask, in the after effects of the riot, do you expect that there'll just be some homegrown elements of art that may appear from your students or from the community And then does the MICA have any programs already, or does it maybe plan any programs with the community as far as using art as an expression?
Yeah, excellent question. Thank you so much for asking that. Well, first of all, the artistic response already happened, and it happened probably much faster than people realize. The unrest happened on Monday evening, and on Tuesday morning, for example, I'll just give you two examples. One of our professors, photography professors, Nate Lawson, took his class out to the streets because he just thought, right after the unrest, we couldn't just do a class normally, so he took his entire photo class, and they went to different cleanup sites and starting taking photos of citizens really crossing neighborhoods, helping each other. And it was the first set of positive pictures that came out to counter the overwhelmingly negative media coverage of the city. And then it was actually picked up by CNN and different media outlets because it was one of the first positive artistic response. And then we have another professor, Valeska Apopolo, who the very next day, again on Tuesday, brought her colleagues and worked with the Black Cherry Puppet Theater to organize free puppet shows and mural painting for kids who couldn't go to school because public schools were closed in different neighborhoods. And we have multiple examples of that. There were immediate response from MICA faculty, students, and staff, because we, as we may have a chance to talk about later on, kind of social engagement is a very big pedagogical commitment at MICA. It's a very important part of our education. Now, your question about what other programs are putting in place, we have actually three graduate programs dedicated to exploration of social collaboration to bring about positive change. One is the MFA in MA as in social design. One is MFA in curatorial practice, MA in curatorial practice, and MFA in community arts. And all three programs have a program content that very much now driven as a response by the unrest. And then school-wide, prior to the unrest, because we are forward-looking to the 21st century, we're already committed, and this is a little pressure, a whole year-long conversation on diversity, equity, inclusion, and globalization before the unrest. So when the unrest happened, it positioned our college community very well to take this year-long dialogue that will start this September to bridge that with our external community. So I've been in conversation with councilmen to see how we can bring our conversation, the community dialogue into it, so that MICA can play our small but critical part in sustaining a conversation about a city so that we don't just let the issue drop because order has returned.
And look where you are. Look where MICA is located physically. I mean, right on the edge of West Baltimore there.
Correct.
Those three master's programs you mentioned?
Graduate programs.
Mm-hmm. So you say they all have more of a focus on Baltimore in the coming year?
No, they have more of a focus on social contributions and how design thinking can bring about positive change. And because of that, inevitably, they actually have Baltimore in the curriculum.
Because I was going to ask you about the role of the artist in regard to something like this, which most of us have never been through before.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the overt thing, like the murals that are painted. There's a Freddie Gray mural. But, not so overtly. Maybe artists, commit themselves to the city,
I would say, I think, again, as I mentioned before, we need to think about it as a reactive response and a proactive response. I think it's necessary to be reactive because we have to address the issues right in front of us. And a lot of the artistic interventions and kind of design thinking solutions are more reactive. But the proactive is really looking at the underlying kind of racial issues, underlying social economic inequity that really drove the unrest. And I believe, and I think not when I say I am really on behalf of the MICA community and many people I've talked to, in the city, feel that in a way, kind of the investment in the creative economy of the city and then making possible equitable way for multiple populations of the city to tap into that kind of prosperity would be actually a proactive way for us to redefine the city, but also bring, again, economic opportunities to a diverse pool of citizens.
Samuel Hoy, president of the Merrill Institute College of Art, with 1,800 undergrads, 300 graduate students.
Yes, about 2,200 total.
Wow. I want to ask you about this there's some, I said there's a busy time for MICA, yes, because of projects that you're involved with, in with Johns Hopkins, for instance. I want to talk about two of these.
Yes.
The Center Theater on North
Avenue.
And
that's also with the Maryland Film Festival, too.
And Maryland. Well, let's talk about each one and describe them. These are the old theaters on North Avenue. Mm-hmm. Parkway Theater is another one. And then there's the Motor House building, also on North Avenue, I believe, right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. So what's going on? Let me take one at a time there. The Center Theater.
Right. Well, actually, if you may permit me, I would tie the Center Theater and the Parkway Theater together because it's really a three-way partnership between MICA, Johns Hopkins, and Maryland Film Festival. And the three-way partnership works as follows. Johns Hopkins' undergraduate film program and MICA's new graduate program in filmmaking are coming together to share a space in the Center Theater. And this is a landmark theater that actually was used for a car dealership and now has been restored by...
It was originally a car dealership, like 1916.
Right, that's right.
And then became a theater.
Theater, yes.
And it's been empty for a while.
Right, and now it's actually been reused for creative purposes. Huh. So we are taking the second floor and we are sharing spaces so that Hopkins students, faculty, and MICA students and faculty will share soundstage, auditorium for FRIMS screening, seminar rooms, and we'll also be cross-registering and cross-attending different classes. So we have actually wonderful collaboration between the two programs.
And where is that in its rehabilitation?
That one is opening in a month.
Oh, a month away.
Yes,
to
yes.
The
we
opening
had
of
we
the
had
center.
The marquee light switching ceremony earlier this spring,
yeah,
and then the building will actually open in August.
And then there's the Parkway also on
yes.
North Avenue.
And the reason it's a three-way partnership is because the Maryland Film Festival is restoring Parkway Kitty Corner to Center Theater, and this is the first really film collaboration in the country that has a film festival and a filmmaking programs on undergrad and graduate level working together on a daily basis. Most of the other collaborations are, one plus one, meaning that you finish the school or you may do internships in the summer and the wintertime, and then the students might get some experiences, as interns, afterwards. Because of our proximity, we'll be able to collaborate with Maryland Film Festival on almost a daily basis. Our students will not only get the creative education, but they will understand the business side of things, how films are distributed, how films are shown, how films are curated, and that's a very rich filmmaking education that people are not going to get anywhere else.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you about is the Motor House, also on North Avenue. You're involved in that project as well, right?
We're involved as, I would say, enthusiastic partner. Mm-hmm. We really cannot claim ownership of that project. That project really is a brainchild of Robert Deutsch Foundation.
Robert Deutsch Foundation.
Correct. Right. And the Robert Deutsch Foundation is also doing a companion development called Open Works, which is a MICA incubator and accelerator over Greenmount West, which is on the edge of Station North. Hmm. And but those two developments, I would say, have been inspired, I think, partly by MICA's homesteading with the Lazarus Studio Center directly across from the future site of Motor House.
That's 120 West North Avenue.
Correct.
Well, you got to really stop and walk around there to see what's going on North Avenue.
Oh, there's a whole new vibrancy of the neighborhood that actually has been catalyzed by art and design homesteading.
And did you say when the Parkway might open? How long?
The Parkway, I think the fundraising is going very well. And so all going according to plan, they'll be open about a year from now.
Samuel Hoy is our guest, the president of the Maryland Institute College Art. And we're going to take a break here, and some of your alumni are going to be joining us in the studio. We'll meet some of the school's graduates, including one who's working with Johns Hopkins, the neurology department, and a duo who have had exhibitions in New York, L.A., and Italy, and just won a nice award. So they'll be joining us here in the studio.
Great.
Samuel Hoy, our guest, president of the Maryland Institute. If you have a question for him about Station North or anything that's going on over there at MICA, 410-662-8780. The email address for Midday, midday@wypr.org. If you write a quick question by email, I'll get it on the air for you. I put Samuel Hoy on the spot and ask you this question.
Okay.
Before you knew there was a job available at the Maryland Institute College of Art, that they were going to be looking for a new president, Fred Lazarus was going to retire, before you knew all that and you heard MICA, say 5 years ago, somebody said MICA, Baltimore, MICA. What was MICA's reputation in your mind?
one of the top schools in the country, a very progressive thinking school. And the reason is that I actually had knowledge of Micah and of Fred. Fred and I had been colleagues for over 20 years. So we have 20 years of friendship, or over 20 years of friendship and collegiality before Micah's position became open. So I'm very much aware of actually Micah's trajectory and development and potential.
I only ask it because I want. It's one of those things maybe some people take for granted in Baltimore, just how good it is.
Yeah, and also for Baltimore,
what's its reputation?
Yeah, I did work 9 years in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
At the Corcoran. So, right. But as I like to tell people in Baltimore, seeing Baltimore from the lens of D.C. is very different from understanding Baltimore while being in Baltimore. So at that time, I did multiple site visits for a variety of projects, but I really didn't get a strong sense of Baltimore as being such a livable, cool city and such a potent, again, fertile ground for art and design incubation.
The city has a lot of potential.
Yeah, the city actually has more than potential. City has a very vibrant art scene that I think is full of art, artistic capital. But the potential is translating that capital into a vibrant creative economy and using art and design as a transformative driving force for community development and economic vibrancy. I think that is the potential. But yeah. I wouldn't just say that it's all potential because all potential means
I'm with you on that.
We have a lot of substance here.
When I walk around, drive around, take the bus past North Avenue there sometimes, I'm kind of shocked at all that's happening.
Yeah, and also when you hear about the stories of these three young artists, you'll be so impressed by basically the potential of the next generation.
Kat McNally is with us, Malcolm Lomax and Daniel Wickerham. And Lomax and Wickerham come as a partnership, a collaboration. It's nice to meet you both, Wickerham and Lomax. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
All right. And Kat McNally, nice to meet you, Kat. Yeah. Gentlemen, I'm going to start with Kat first. Kat graduated in 2012, it says here.
Yes.
What brought you to MICA?
I was aware of the absolutely stellar illustration program, and that's what first drew me there. And then I kind of got a little bit suckered in by animation. So I ended up being an animation and illustration major.
Where'd you come from, Kat?
I'm originally from just outside of Chicago, Aurora, Illinois.
Aurora.
Yeah.
Shark Eaters, Rise of the Dolphins. This is what we're going to talk about here. This is a video game app that you designed.
Yes.
And it says here, to help patients working to regain skills after a brain injury.
Yes.
You're the lead artist for the Johns Hopkins School of Neurology Department's Brain Learning and Animation Movement Lab.
Blam.
Blam. John Krakauer, right?
Yes.
Runs. Now, he was on this show, and he told us about how he was developing, working with dolphins at the National Aquarium. Is that where this came from?
Yes, it is. Yes. Yeah, we worked quite a bit with the aquarium and Sue Hunter, who was the head of the dolphin exhibit. She gave us absolutely unparalleled access to the animals, and we were able to just study them all the time, and I got to go back and draw them a lot, and it was just
why
fantastic.
Dolphins? Why did you choose dolphins?
Well,
but what was the mission here? What was the project? What was your aim, your goal?
So Dr. Krakauer actually initially came up with this, and he wanted an I'll first start by saying that we have a mouse lab that we also work with, and we found with them when they suffer strokes, it really helps them to be in an enriched environment. So you give them toys, you give them friends, all that sort of stuff. And right now with stroke therapy, which is what we're primarily focused on, after a patient has a stroke, you really just sit in a bed and, kind of wait a couple months out for your therapy. So we kind of looked at that and said, that's not good. We want to give them, just sort of something that makes therapy fun. You know, it's not fun. It's, you're impaired, you're sick, you're not happy, but we don't want them to feel that way. We want to give them basically like their own Pixar movie to star in, their own sort of, just fun to have, just a really high quality, enriched environment, so
okay.
to speak. Yeah.
Okay. And that's what got you to dolphins.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
because dolphins are pretty cool. And,
they are very cool. And they also, I don't know if you know this, they live in water.
Yeah, I've noticed that, yeah.
Which means that basically if you are controlling a dolphin, you have just total free 3D movement,
okay.
Which was a big deal.
So shark eaters?
Yes.
Rise of the Dolphins.
Yes.
The dolphins are fending off the sharks in your game? Is that it?
Yes, yeah. So we have, Max and Haley has a whole big storyline behind it, which unfortunately we didn't get to fully explore in the game, but we're hoping to in later games to come, which we're actually working on. We're working on the sequel right now. But basically, we wanted a game where it's just all action packed, all battling, and yeah.
If I was a person that had a brain injury, mm-hmm. and was undergoing therapy, mm-hmm. this would be in my hands, right? I'd be using my hands or not?
Well, so actually we have two versions of it. We have one on the iPad, and then we have a version that's actually comes with a robot. So a lot of times, you know, when you're impaired, you can't really move or when you have a stroke, you're impaired and you can't move your arm that well. So what we do is we have this robot that is basically a gravity compensation. So it removes the weight of your arm, essentially, and kind of just allows you to have a lot of free movement.
Wow.
And so that's what we use for the patients.
Okay. So my question would be then, because I haven't seen your game animated. I've just seen some still images from
yes.
it. But why would it be of particular benefit to someone who suffered a brain injury versus another video game?
Well, so that's actually a big part of what my boss, Dr. Omar Ahmad, does. I'm sure John might have mentioned him when he was on the program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. He basically created a system that's sort of a combination of animation and simulation. And what that means is the dolphin that you see moving is actually reacting to forces. You know, when you play a normal video game, like, you know, first person shooter or whatever, you know, kind of push a button or move the control in one direction and an animation plays out.
Right.
And your character walks forward or, you know, jumps or something. But there's a disconnect because you can tell that that's just an animation. You don't actually have control. Like, even subconsciously, you know that that's not quite what's happening. You're just pushing a button. But with our simulation, you are actually fully in control. You know, you see all of Bandit, that's the dolphin, all of Bandit's muscles, all of his bones are moving to your command.
Oh, I got to see this.
Yeah.
That sounds great, Cat McNally.
Yeah.
Congratulations on that. So
you've
fully developed this,
mm-hmm.
and what happens next?
Well, like I said before, we're working on a sequel. We're doing a shark-based game, so the shark is going to be the protagonist now.
President Samuel Hoy of Mica, what do you think when you're listening to this story of the development of that game?
I'm so excited by it for two reasons. One is that it always makes me very happy when you know, Mica alum, but also all creatives are able to branch out of the traditional box of you know, kind of gallery and you know, studios, and really branch and contribute their talents to create new ways of looking at things and solving things in other disciplines. So I think that's just terrific. And I think we have many, you know, Mica faculty alum who are doing all sorts of things that people will be astounded to find out. Number two is that Mica has actually launched in 2 years' time a game design program that's based on the current concentration of games art at Mica. So I think, you know, I think Kat's, you know, success and work bodes very well for the new program. And we want to launch that program precisely to take advantage of the diversification of Qi game theory and game application now.
Now we move over to Malcolm Lomax and Daniel Wickerham, known as Wickerham and Lomax, collaborating for several years now. You guys went to Mica a while ago. You've been out since 2009, is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, Daniel or Malcolm, just take a minute, and since we're on radio, you kind of have to describe your art. I know that's tough. You got to see these things. They're installations, they're prints, they're videos,
But I think we do have something in common with the app that she was designing. Like, you know, one thing our work considers is how does an individual identify amongst a group differently than how statistics might identify that other person or that individual. So in other words, like, what are the parameters for life, and how can you decide if those are correct, and do we need alternatives?
Okay, and how about you, Malcolm? What would you say about your collaborations with Daniel? How would you describe him for a radio audience that actually can't see what you've produced?
Well, we usually make work that's about social exchange and how it can be put into forms. And we kind of migrate through forms. The last thing we did was like a televisual website that was based around an ensemble cast and how these kind of peoples would be networked with each other. And then we kind of moved into exploring other groups now, which are like subcultures in the urban community or frats or gangs. But they all have this kind of investigation of social exchange and access and initiation rituals and things like that.
That seemed to be a common theme through some of your work.
That's like a huge theme of the work, this collaborative process.
This exhibit you have at the Baltimore Museum of Art now, this involves the fraternity idea, fraternity theme?
Yeah.
You picked up frat paddles, fraternity paddles, that's included in the exhibits?
Yeah, we wanted to take them to a place of further customization and not choose a specific frat, but kind of use them formally, and we kind of reorganized the letters and printed these huge vinyl stickers that kind of surround them, and then we kind of fully customized them through mesh bags and locking zippers and things
good,
like that.
Good, Daniel.
Yeah, the paddles host pictures of birdhouses, so there's multiple social communities being represented. You have fraternities, you have birdhouses, you have these social spaces, and then they're customized to look like they're ready for a gay club.
Wow.
Which has its own rules.
This is at the BMA now, the Baltimore Museum of Art. All right. And Daniel Wickerham is from Ohio, Malcolm Lomax from South Carolina, and this started while you were still students at MICA?
Yeah, we met at MICA, and we started hanging out in each other's studios, and then once we graduated, we had our first show at Open Space, which was a gallery that some of our classmates opened. And since then, we've just been creating opportunities in Baltimore and elsewhere, and this show at the BMA will be our fifth in Baltimore since 2009.
Wow, that's excellent. And you're finalists for the 2015 Janet and Walter Sondheim Artscape Prize, which will be awarded. That's a $25,000 fellowship that'll be awarded July 11th. During Artscape, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Hey, I have a question here that came in by email, so I want to ask Malcolm and Daniel this question, and also Kat, you can take it too. This is a question from where is it here? This was a good question somebody sent me. Don't tell me I lost it here. Oh. I think, yeah, this is for Daniel and Malcolm, but maybe something Kat can respond to, too. You've had exhibitions in cities around the world, but you've stuck around Baltimore after graduating from MICA, so you must have some investment in the city. What is the artist's role? What is your role in defining the city or in defining any community? You want to try that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think that artists don't have a kind of a moral obligation, so I think, you know, create your own rules. Find a fun way to deal with things. Don't pay too much rent. Baltimore's a great city for that.
Okay. You don't feel there's any particular moral obligation to the...
I also think we had this huge interest in The Wire, but we wanted to build some kind of fan fiction off of it, so yeah. We needed these kind of notions about location and being here enough to kind of build our own kind of version off of it. So, also, Daniel had moved, but came back, and it's just more so not a thing about being in Baltimore for Baltimore, but kind of our friendship. Our friendship's been a huge part. I was still here, and he came back for our friendship.
That's cool.
It was getting hard to collaborate in two different cities, so I moved back.
Yeah, and the rent is lower.
Yeah.
And Kat, how about you? How would you answer that question about, you know, sense of place, what the community means to you, what is your role in it? As an artist, what do you think?
I would say I like their answer very much. So kind of building off that, I would say that every place kind of needs an artist. I think that's a really good, you know, kind of thing to have. And I think especially in collaborative environments like my lab, it's really nice to have people who aren't necessarily 100%, you know, neuroscience, 100% BME, 100% computer science, 100% art. You know, we're all kind of just this big, like, mesh of people, and it allows for a lot of really creative ideas and, you know, creative solutions to problems. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's how we came up with the game. We're working on a couple other, like, you know, some robotics things with a robotics expert. We have a trial going on right now, and none of that would be possible if not for just this, you know, all of us.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Hopefully I would like to think that I am contributing a lot to that.
And Daniel and Malcolm, how connected do you feel to the MICA community, to Station North, the territory we're talking about here, physically, and the people? What would you say?
A little bit connected. I mean, we have always used the city since we started working in 2009. You know, a lot of walking around the city, a lot of...
As the subject.
Yeah, city as a subject. So I kind of think of the whole city together. I mean, we're always in East Baltimore, West Baltimore. So not so much in kind of the arts district, but the whole city altogether is kind of in our consciousness.
Do you think you'll be tackling the subject of, I call it the Baltimore Spring, the uprising, the unrest of April? That's in your consciousness? That be something that'll be showing up in your artwork? What do you think?
I think it's very much in the work. You know, the show at the BMA has a lot of ideas about access and privilege to access and who creates the rules for letting you into a space. What are those rules? And I think with what's happened with Freddie Gray, you can kind of take those events with you into the BMA, and there's going to be some correlations.
Okay. Is it that you're... current exhibits at the Baltimore Museum of Art until through Artscape or
until August 9th.
Oh,
August
9th. Good. All right. Thank you, Malcolm. Malcolm Lomax and Daniel Wickerham. That's Wickerham and Lomax. They're collaborators and they're finalists for the Sondheim Award. So good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being on the show today. And Kat McNally, nice to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And President Samuel Hoy, a new president, finishing his first year just about at the Merrill Institute College of Art. Mike wrote in to say, my favorite week or two of the year is late August and early September when MICA freshmen come to school, each one outdoing the other with individualist personal style, including hairstyles and fashion. It doesn't last long, but it's like a two-week costume party in the city and something to behold. Nice email there. Thank you very much. Nice to meet you, sir.
Thank you. Nice to meet
you. Yeah, come back and visit us again another time.
Well, thank you for the invitation today.
Yeah, and we'll try to keep everybody posted on what's going on there on North Avenue with MICA and the other collaborators. Thank you very much. We'll take a break here on midday. Folks, we come back. Rona Cabell joining us from the Chesapeake Bay Journal to catch up on the Supreme Court ruling yesterday on the power plants and also to talk about, you know, the environmental aspect of Governor Hogan's decision to kill the Red Line light rail system through Baltimore. Short break on midday. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here, 410-662-8780. Now, we just take a moment here to talk to Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal, who's a Midday contributor. Of course, she comes to us once a month for Midday on the Bay. But I thought we would check in with Rona today to catch up a little bit and assess this Supreme Court ruling yesterday. Hello, Rona.
Hello, Dan.
Power plants and the Environmental Protection Agency and the Supreme Court. First, let's just go over what did the court rule yesterday?
The court ruled that EPA really needs to take into consideration the cost of these regulations before they impose them on the power plant industry. They did not invalidate the rule, which some of the coal plants and power plants are trying to say this is a huge victory. They invalidated the rule. They did not invalidate it. They're sending it back to the D.C. Court of Appeals, which often rules in favor of EPA rules and has been particularly sympathetic to Obama's rules. So they're basically saying you didn't consider the cost of what this would tax the industry with, and you need to consider that in the future. And meanwhile, the EPA actually was considering it. It just takes a really long time for the agency to do anything. So they put out the rule, and then they were kind of working backwards on the costs.
So eventually, they would consider the costs of, say, you know, new pollution devices or something. The court is saying, no, you have to consider it right from the beginning.
Well, they're saying that they should have considered it from the beginning. They should have considered it earlier. But, you know, we have basically an epidemic of childhood asthma. We have all kinds of breathing diseases and cancers that are related to these emissions. So the EPA chose to look at those and say, you know, we need to get these under control and focus on the health impacts primarily, which is their job. Their job is to protect the environment. Their job is not to crunch numbers for the industry. That's not what the Environmental Protection Agency is supposed to do.
Hmm.
So they were doing what they were supposed to do, but I think we're so kind of used to these decisions being weighed to industry that the industry wanted it to be known that this was a burden. And actually, the industry has already been doing many of the things to comply with this rule. So I'm not really sure how much impact it's going to have that they said, hey, you need to look at costs
okay.
earlier.
So maybe it's not that big a deal. Is it?
I mean, it's a big deal is that we were riding this pretty progressive agenda with the Supreme Court, with the marriage equality. There were a couple other important Obama initiatives that
mm-hmm.
that were approved, and so I think it's a setback, but it's not a huge setback. It's maybe a reminder that you know the majority of the Supreme Court has been. It can be at times hostile to environmental protections. And so, you know, you need to kind of be aware of that.
Right.
But I don't think it's a huge deal. I think the agency needs to consider costs and will do that. It would be a big deal if they said that the rule was unconstitutional and that power plants didn't have to follow it anymore,
right.
but that's not what they're saying.
You're talking here about emissions of mercury and other hazardous air pollutants. I noticed the Sun's report on this today. I thought this was interesting. In terms of mercury contamination in Maryland, two-thirds of which officials say is imported by prevailing winds from polluting facilities beyond the state's border. And some of that mercury gets into water systems in the state and lakes.
Right. So we talk about that as the airshed. And for a long time, we said that a lot of our mercury pollution was coming from Ohio. I'm not sure how much that is still the case. I think we're producing plenty of our own right here in the Bay watershed. But one of the rulings that was decided favorably by the Supreme Court is that you could put limits on how much pollution could come from other states. It's sort of a way to help because air pollution doesn't obviously recognize state boundaries, so you could put limits on what pollution was coming to you from other states.
Hmm.
However, I mean, if you have a robust federal system where everybody has to follow the same rules, then you shouldn't be having mercury coming over from other states. There should be really one rule, and everyone should have to follow it to reduce these pollutions, which, by the way, are tremendously harmful, not just for humans, but for aquatic life. And when we eat those fish that are full of mercury, you know, we get sick too.
How would you say we're doing in Maryland overall, Rona? About 10 years ago, we had the Healthy Air Act passed here that required the coal-burning power plants to cut down on their emissions of mercury and others. How would you say we're doing?
Well, I think we're doing better than many other states that are saying you can't say the word climate change. Wisconsin and Florida, we're doing better because we have acknowledged that it's a problem, and we did enter into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative and make some progress. You know, you could always do more. I think we seem to have a decent handle on it, maybe compared to some of the other things I cover, like pollution from agriculture, which is much harder to control.
Right.
At least with the mercury, it's coming out of one, one tower, and you can put limits on it and put a scrubber in it and control it. So, really, with the mercury from power plants, it's political will and it's money. Whereas with the other pollution that I write about and we talk about so often, there's a lot of other factors going into that.
Hey, Rona, I just wanted to get your comments about this. A very big story in the news the last week has been Governor Larry Hogan's decision not to fund the Red Line, not to go ahead with that light rail system. And we discussed this in terms of the socioeconomic impacts of not building that thing and not, you know, we talked about it in terms of job creation, getting people to jobs. We didn't really talk about it in terms of, you know, its environmental value of moving to light rail, more mass transit, getting people out of cars. But
well, I'm really glad you asked me about that, Dan, because, you know, we just talked about the power plants and how that seems to be getting better. One-third of the nitrogen coming into the Chesapeake Bay is coming from atmospheric deposition, which means coming from the air down to the water. a lot of that's coming from tailpipes. Now, we have improved upon that by making the standards for cars cleaner. But then we're just putting more people on the roads because we have a lot of people who want to live in the Baltimore-Washington region. And because we're not offering them a really good, cohesive transit system, they're driving. And so there's more of them on the roads, and that basically negates what progress we've made with making the cars cleaner. Mm-hmm. On a personal note, traffic is terrible for one's health. People who sit in traffic a lot tend to eat poorly. They have less time to exercise. They're not in good health. They're generally not in very good moods if you have to be sitting on the beltway traffic. And I think what we need, the Red Line might not have been the solution, but we need something. We need an alternative. We have three transportation systems in Baltimore that don't talk to each other, bus, subway, and light rail. And it's really hard to get from here to there. And the solution is not just fragmenting our forests and building more roads. It's trying to, for the environmental sake and for the public health sake and for the economic sake of the people who don't have cars, we need to be able to get them where they need to go.
Yeah.
And we can't just rely on the car.
You know, part of the disappointment here is exactly that. We had a woman who called in on the show last Friday, said she was a millennial, you know. She identified herself as a millennial, and that's the kind of person we want moving into Baltimore City, staying here. And she said she was disappointed. She didn't understand this decision because this is about the 21st century. This is about moving forward with a progressive mass transit, getting people out of cars, less fossil fuel emissions, all of that. And it doesn't, you know, in that respect, it doesn't look good. I don't know if the city delegation to Annapolis can do anything about this, getting something in its place that is on the green side of things. I assume it's just generally better to have people, groups of people in mass transit that runs on electricity than it is having them in their cars. I mean, it's an assumption.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't have it in front of me, but I assume that to be the case.
Right. And a lot of buses in cities, including Baltimore, are running on either electricity or natural gas.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, to me, it's the difference between being a first-class city and a second-tier city. I mean, if you look at all the really great American cities, they all have a top-notch transportation system. They have a bus, they have a subway, they have some way. And as a result, you know, more people are walking, more people are bicycling. And I just think that it makes people healthier. It's healthier for the economy. It's healthier for the city. So whereas, you know, where we live, how would one even get to Annapolis without a car? There used to be a bus. I don't know if there still is. But we're not even connecting our major cities, let alone our suburbs to our cities or our neighborhoods to our downtown.
Right.
So we have a really long way to go on transit and bikes and all of it. And I feel like we're kind of stuck in this old mentality of let's build roads.
Right.
And it's just not really, it's not attractive to young people.
Thank you. It's not attractive to middle-aged people either.
right,
thank you.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, Rona. Rona will be back July 19th is the next edition of Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal. So thanks for this today, Rona. We'll see you later in the month. Have a great holiday weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thank you. Here I am talking about the holiday weekend. It's only Tuesday. Yeah, a lot of people can't wait for that. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the show today, and you'll come back tomorrow, folks. Dan Roderick's here for our staff at Midday. Also, thank you again to Bagby Pizza Company for providing lunch for our guests visiting us today from MICA. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.